hello everyone and welcome to the Recovery Cast. Ron and Dave here, along with Boyd and Chris, to remind you where we left off in our last episode. Let's listen again to Jimmy N. from Lincoln, Nebraska, talking about the blood of the blood, sweat, and tears that went into the writing of the basic text.
Well, my neighbor offered me a ream of paper and the use of his copy machine, so that wasn't the problem. The problem was postage. So there were five of us sitting around the kitchen table at my place one day, and I said, made the comment, well, I guess I've sold blood for, sold plasma to support my aunt. Maybe we can probably make a trip to the plasma center and get a pint of blood is $15 and a roll of stamps is $15. And so the guys all went down to blood bank and sold blood. And we went back to the house and laughing and joking, and each of us had a roll of stamps in our pocket, and we used the address flyers and sent them to every address that I could get my hands on.
Yeah, that was it. At one time, that was actually a title that we, of the presentation that we tossed around, was Blood, Sweat, and Tears. And this is the blood portion, and the sweat comes even more so as the momentum for the book ramps up, and then we'll tell you about some of the tears in there too. So,
yeah, sponsors often say things like, hey, I want you to go pick up this person and get them to a meeting, or I want you to go to this jail and be part of an H&I panel. You know, very rarely you hear sponsors saying, hey, go sell some plasma. We need to get some basic texts to those guys in the prison. Do you want to mention, because this is another story that we need to capture, but do you want to kind of just describe a little bit about George?
If my memory serves me correct, George was about 17 at this time and was getting clean in Philadelphia. And he heard about these literature conferences, and he'd never met anybody from the South before at all. And so when he saw this person to call in Atlanta, he called the person and he spoke the guy's name just like it said on the paper. And so he called the number and somebody answered, and he asked to speak to Boo. Can I please speak to Boo? And he said he heard howling on the on the other side of the phone.
And, how did he get to that Nebraska, Lincoln, Nebraska, the second World Lit Conference?
Yeah, and he sold his washing machine and dryer in order to be able to buy a train ticket to get to Lincoln, Nebraska. And it was actually Jim Nichols who picked him up at the train station. So George followed the conferences around. I'm not sure exactly how many he went to, three or four. But he just tells the story that when he went, man, he was hooked. And it really was a huge, at this time, the momentum was building. And that's exactly the type of enthusiasm that you got, that people would be willing to sell appliances to be able to get a ticket to go. And that's the self-funding aspect of it, again, that we talk about.
Yeah, he attended Lincoln, Memphis, Santa Monica, the second, third, and fourth, and then attended the seventh in Philadelphia, actually hosted the seventh.
Yeah, actually, Jim made a huge financial contribution, and any motorcycle riders out there will know. Jim actually sold his Harley so that he could finance people to go to the very first World Lit Conference in Wichita, Kansas. So that's actually a fact. It was a little Sportster is what he sold. And he said his wife and I believe four or five sponsees loaded up the van and went to Wichita, Kansas. So,
well, maybe the bar was just moved a little higher. You're talking about a Harley there versus what's a little blood.
Yeah, yeah, right. Yeah, good point.
Bar is definitely high. You know, there's always these neat things that happen as a result of the research that we've done. And you know, yeah. I think of contacting this woman at one point in Louisiana saying, hey, I'm inquiring to see if you have a copy of your 1970 master's thesis, you know, and she's like, you want to know about my master's thesis from 1970? Like, why? So people are often, you know, kind of blown away or, you know, shocked to find out that people are interested in some of the things that they had done. But a story that just, you know, really blows me away is Boyd had gone up and met with Danny in Philly and went around to do some interviews, and they went around to interview George. And at this point, George had been had kind of stopped going to NA meetings. And a couple things happened. One, Boyd was set up with a camera, and they were going to try to video record the interview. And the second thing that happened was that their air conditioner was out, and Danny had recommended somebody in the fellowship who came over the next day and worked on it. And basically, the daughter starts saying, why are these people interested in you, Dad? Why are they coming over here asking you these stories? Why do people keep thanking you, saying, you helped save my life? This is a story that was completely unknown to his daughter. And he basically explained that when her younger brother, who had autism, came along, that he required such care that, you know, he kind of had disengaged from the fellowship in order to raise his son and care for his son. And the daughter and the other son said, you know, Dad, we're old enough now to take care of our brother. You know, you can go out to a meeting once a week or however frequently it is. And I had a chance to talk to his daughter, and I kind of said, well, what difference has that made with your dad going back to meetings? And she just said, you know, he's happier. So in some ways, you know, just inquiring about somebody's involvement of in a historical nature can have a profoundly positive impact upon them and their family.
It really is. It's cool. Danny called me one day a little while after this, and it may have been as much as a year. And he said, I just wanted to tell you that George came over to my home group this Saturday morning, and he wanted to thank me for bringing you over to do the interview because it got him reminiscing about NA and how much he really enjoyed it and such as that. And he came over to thank me for that because he had actually recommitted to NA, and he wanted to tell me that. He just wanted to tell me thank you. And, you know, and that was just some of those wonderful gifts that you get along this journey.
Nice.
You know, that really and truly, it's like, wow, you know, higher power doing the work. So anyway, moving right along into the nuts and bolts of how the book was made. We've learned that there were 800 pages of material that was collected for the Second World Lit conference. And this was, you know, this was work that was done in between the conferences during those 11 months. And it was assembled in a pretty unique fashion. And the material was first cut and filed under different chapter headings. You would sit there and you'd cut it and you'd say, well, I think this works in, you know, chapter 5. I think this works in chapter 4. And you'd go over there and put it in a pile. And then a work group would take that particular pile, and then they'd go, it'd be usually be small number work groups, 3 or 4, and they'd go, at least that's what I've been told anyway, 3 or 4, and then they'd go work on it, and they'd start, you know, putting it together on a sheet of paper, but it's a very time-consuming and unique way to do cut and paste of creating a book and filling it up.
We've also had to explain to some of our younger members who've seen the presentation that this is not a Control X, Control V on the keyboard.
Here's Motorcycle Ed.
I believe that the second one that I showed up at, the real treat for me was get to do what all the other people had got to do in kindergarten that I didn't get to do because I didn't get to go to kindergarten was little itty-bitty scissors and cut up pieces of paper and take the paste stick and put it on the back and paste it on another piece of paper. And the kid in me, of course, I didn't know what to call it at that time, just went berserk. You know, hot diggity doggy dum. You know, and 12 hours of this in his life. Yeah, you know, and somebody walk up and start rubbing your back.
And in the slide presentation, we actually we have a piece up there that is that's a representation of this cut and paste. And at the very top of it, you see handwritten disease aspect. And then we've got another one here, too. It's handwritten, and then there's typing, and then there's handwriting again. And then there's another group of typing that you can tell this is single space and not double space. So it comes from a different source. And then you've got other typing down there that comes from even a different source. And this was the type of cut and paste that they did. And for the best way for me to tell you about how to go see this, to tell the podcast audience, it's here again, is go to narchive.magshare.net. And if you look under Chris and Boyd's work products, you'll find three different versions of this particular PowerPoint that are there. And so you can actually see what we are seeing.
magshare.net/narchive/ is the URL.
Okay. Well, the other thing is if you just Google narchive, it'll come up.
The next bit of audio we're going to hear is from Charles Kay. Charles attended three of the World Lit conferences. His story is an Indian without a tribe, and it appears in the basic text in the first through the fifth editions. Listen to this conversation about consensus, 1980 style.
Hi, everybody. I'm Charles Kay, and I'm an addict. Some of the things you might not, that they touched on a little bit, like the cut and paste, that's how the whole book was put together. People cutting single lines out, pasting them on paper, photocopying it, passing it out to like everybody here. You would read it and go, no, I don't like that. We want to change that. So you cut that out, you paste it again, you re-photocopy it, and you kept doing that till you got to something you liked in your workshop. Then it went to the main group, and the literature committee was doing consensus before consensus was popular. That's how every line of the book was approved by consensus.
We'll jump ahead just a bit to continue with Charles's voice, talking more about consensus, the way it was applied at the subsequent literature conference.
At the sixth literature conference, we read each line and voted on every single line. Not whole chapters, not pages or paragraphs, but every line. And as I read each line, I would check yes or no. If it was a no, it went back and got worked on. And that's where the white approval form came from, was that conference there. After every line had been approved, then that was made up and sent out as something that, here's our book. Here's what we're offering to you as a finished product.
And then we go here to the Rainbow Connection.
The Rainbow Connection was one of several newsletters that were circulating in the fellowship at the time, in the absence of any mass media or social media like we have today. The Rainbow Connection itself was published out of Marietta, Georgia, where Bo lived and where the efforts to write the basic text were sort of centered. So it was a key newsletter of the day.
And this is October of 1980, and this is actually after the Second World Lit Conference was over with. And it's a brief history of it. It says that the Second World Lit Conference of NA added at least 1,000 man hours to the effort towards a basic text for our fellowship. Here goes, you know, the sweat part of blood, sweat, and tears. And it goes on to say that the Lincoln Conference will be remembered as an occasion where our book began to take shape. Individual sacrifice and dedication on a part of the Lincoln Fellowship that went far beyond merely setting up the conference. The positive atmosphere, lodging for attending members in homes, and fine meetings each night went a long way towards raising spirit and enthusiasm for the effort. They got us the first floor of the Lincoln Federal Building, a fine copier, which turned out to be the main piece of equipment for the conference, and five electric typewriters. About 10,000 copies were consumed by the conference. We worked together the last 72 hours, almost straight through. The personal support from the members from Lincoln made all this possible. We are grateful. We are grateful. See you in Memphis.
And the date on that is October 1980. Mm-hmm. That was right after the World Convention in Wichita, which was 1980, Memorial Day weekend, right about now in 1980. And that convention was just a buzz with this, with solicitation to everybody there to come to this conference and be part of the book. And I was at that convention, but wasn't really able to do another week because I think it was the following weekend or maybe a month later or so.
No, actually it was following that, Ron, I guess is what it was. Cause just a minute ago, I had remembered in listening to the tapes about how people were either coming in to go to the convention or they were coming from the convention.
They should have been coming from the convention
That makes the most sense.
Significant about this history is we found a draft of this in Joseph P's archives. And when Kermit was down in Raleigh in May of 2008 doing his history presentation, and he'd brought these boxes. I think it was when we discovered this particular document that Kermit was like, yeah, there's some treasures in here. Go ahead and hold on to this and continue scanning and digitizing it. So we originally saw this kind of in a draft form and then saw it later when we had a chance to look at the Rainbow Connection kind of archive collection that Bo had.
So here we go. Although relatively few of us in the Fellowship of Narcotics Anonymous stood at the Lincoln Federal Building in September of 1980, the spirits of our contributors and of those still suffering addicts were all around us, encouraging us, sharing with us their hope and their pain. Those who enjoyed the actual effort were but servants of a larger whole.
And that was the kind of tone that the air was absolutely full of back there, this sort of large sense of history being made and something very significant going on among us.
That is so cool, Ron. I mean, it really is. Because, I mean, you know, Chris and I get the opportunity to study this, but having yourself being been there and heard the and felt the buzz, so to speak, is like that just really, that's awesome to hear about this. And it goes on to say, as a result of addicts meeting in Lincoln, Nebraska in September 1980, a book, a dream, will be realized. It would be inaccurate to say that we have written a book. We all came from many parts of the country and many walks of life, and we all, by the grace of our higher power and the help of our fellow addicts, survived a killing disease. And I love that line right there. We have all, by the grace of our higher power and the help of our fellow addicts, survived a killing disease. In an effort to continue to survive, we have met here to share our experience, strength, and hope. The book is just a reflection of this effort. It is in this spirit that our book will come forth. Addicts all over the world will have the Narcotics Anonymous book for comfort and for study. When we find ourselves by ourselves, we need not be alone. We will have our book, and we will have each other.
It's a pretty good description of what that book ultimately became, too. When we find ourselves by ourselves, we need not be alone. That sense that you get me, I'm not alone, is, you know, rings on every page of that book.
It really does. It really does.
Yeah, I mean, it's when you think about how true that has come to be, is just remarkable. So we, again, it was kind of discovering this where it was like, oh my God, you know, this stuff is just unbelievable. I think a person in your previous podcast said that when they made certain discoveries, they were kind of like, holy shit. And that's kind of what it was like for us as we were looking at this.
You're not going to let that previous person forget his holy shit.
So now we've got the third World Lit Conference starting in of Narcotics Anonymous, and it's happening in Memphis, Tennessee, and it's happening a bit closer too. It, you notice that the second was in September of 1980. This one's happening in January through February, first week in February of 81. So it's right around the corner, 4 to 5 months after this. And
there's an audio clip here that you won't be able to hear, but what's interesting is that Joseph is basically, you know, was campaigning to get the Third World Lit Conference in Memphis. And he says, you know, I didn't really tell anybody that I was the only clean NA member in Memphis, that he kind of misrepresented in some ways, you know, the size of the fellowship. But it speaks to another theme, and I'm sure you guys could do an entire podcast on this, about what has happened when a convention or a conference of this type comes to a community. What's the lasting impact in terms of kind of breathing life into the growth of a new fellowship in that community?
Well, one thing, the fact that there are four of us in this interview rather than three, that's where I came into this orbit through the Philadelphia Convention with you guys.
Yeah.
True. I like that, you know, that thing we were just looking at, the title on the bottom of it is Consensus in Memphis.
It's a beautiful line, Consensus in Memphis.
Yeah. And, you know, we think of consensus-based decision-making as something newfangled in NA, but it's interesting in this whole look back at the basic text how big of a concept that was, that to get a strong consensus, sometimes even a line-by-line consensus, which you may be getting to shortly.
I'll just read a little bit of what's on the screen. It's a flyer for the Third World Literature Conference of Narcotics Anonymous. It says, "We are the book, and together we will have the book, dedicated to the continuation of the effort for new literature for the Fellowship of Narcotics Anonymous, that others may find the freedom of recovery that we have found. Saturday, January 31st through Sunday, February 8th, 1981, in Memphis." And then there's this paragraph. "With gratitude in our cleanliness, we dedicate our NA book to the loving service of our higher power, that through the development of conscious contact with God, no addict seeking recovery need die without having had the chance to find a better way of life. When at the end of the road, we find that we can no longer function as a human being, either with or without drugs, we all face the same dilemma. What is there left to do? There seems to be these alternatives. Either go on as best we can to the bitter ends, jails, institutions, or death, or find a new way to live. For the first time in man's entire history, a simple way has been proving itself in the lives of many addicts. It is available to us all, this simple, spiritual, not religious program known as Narcotics Anonymous. You've been hearing about the book, and the time has come. Consensus in Memphis." There are a few things that jump out at me that I'm going to mention here. One, did you notice that they said there seems to be these alternatives rather than what the little white book actually says? There seems to be this alternative. I've personally always been a little bugged that it says this alternative and then mentions two alternatives. It seems that the writer of this flyer noticed that too and corrected it. Secondly, this paragraph starts out with something that ended up in the preface to the first edition, but did you notice the word cleanliness? As they were working on the book, they were feeling their way forward with some of this language, and eventually settled on clean, clean time, and recovery. But the word cleanliness appeared a few times like this during the process. The final version in the preface to the basic text says, "With gratitude in our recovery, we dedicate our NA book to the loving service of our higher power, that through the development of a conscious contact with God, no addict seeking recovery need die without a chance to find a better way of life. We remain trusted servants in gratitude and loving service, World Literature Committee, World Service Conference, Narcotics Anonymous." But this flyer shows an earlier source of that language. And finally, did you know that the "When at the End of the Road" reading was officially added as a reading card pretty recently? It appears in the little white book, and so many groups spontaneously just chose to read it during their meeting that World Services added it to the regular set of readings. I'm going by memory here, but I'll say about 2000 or just a little later.
The other thing that's interesting is things are becoming much more kind of professional looking in terms of the registration and the flyer. These are typeset, not just kind of hand-drawn. But it says pre-registration is 12. And what's interesting is it gives a selection. Are you an NA member or are you a Naranon member? Which shows kind of the growth and influence of these two parallel fellowships. The consensus in Memphis was the longest conference up until this point. It went from January 31st to February 8th. It was also the largest, with 73 people attending from 14 different states. And they set off on day one, and looking at the minutes from that day, on January 31st, 1981, the goals for this conference are two. Number one, complete a final draft of the Narcotics Anonymous Big Book. Two, submit literature to the World Service Conference in Sun Valley, California, 2 months prior to May 1st. So they wanted to get a draft together and they wanted to get it sent out. We also see that Bo had been in correspondence with the AA General Service Office. He receives a letter dated January 20th, 1981, from Lois Fisher of the General Service Staff. And she says, "Dear Bo, your letter of December 15th came to my desk since one of my staff duties is to serve as a sort of liaison between AA and similar fellowships. Thanks for keeping us informed regarding the progress you are making on your book. We send warm wishes for a successful conference in Memphis. Sincerely yours, Lois." We know that work continued between the second and third literature conference. Chapter One, Who's an Addict, was submitted by the Atlanta Literature Committee. Greg P. worked on Chapter Six, The 12 Traditions. Bud K. and the San Francisco Lit Committee worked on Chapter Seven, Recovery and Relapse. And the Philadelphia Literature Committee worked on Chapter Eight, We Do Recover. And we kind of give some examples of what some of this input looked like.
This is a picture here that we're looking at of Greg P., who actually he wrote the interpretation of the 12 traditions for the basic text, Chapter 6. And it's a very interesting story about that. Greg couldn't make it to the Memphis convention, and so he was in Oregon. Was living in Oregon at the time, and there was a lot of, Bo tells me there was a lot of talk that went on actually about how to get his writings to Memphis, because Greg, they talked about airmailing it, but Greg was going to have to, drive for, quite a few hours down to Portland or to Portland, and then air freight it on a plane over to Memphis. And they decided to do it a pretty unique way, is that they did it with two telephone calls spaced over 6 hours. Greg read the chapters, and this woman named Molly typed what Greg read to her. And so they had the interpretation for Chapter 6, The 12 Traditions.
Yeah, this is another audio piece where Motorcycle Ed is recounting this.
And one of the things that did happen in Memphis was, how long was the conversation phone call?
Two calls totaling over 9 hours.
And a little gal sitting there, and they'd take turns typing. You know, one person would hold the phone to their ear, and they would type, and another person would rub their back so they wouldn't cramp up. And, you know, just over and over and over, times again of the selflessness.
And there's a beautiful picture of Bo holding a phone up to Molly's ear with Molly sitting on a suitcase typing away. It certainly gives a new sense of appreciation when I'm reading the chapter on the traditions in the basic text, thinking about, you know, the painstaking effort that was made to get that material from Oregon to Memphis in time to get it published and approved within that conference.
Now, there's another interesting thing. I spoke with Lois about this.
The Lois in this case was Greg's wife.
Telephone call, and she said she remembers it very, very well because the bill was $300 and some. Greg was actually paying for it. Greg and her were paying for it. And she remembered it because their phone got cut off for about 60 days because of it. And Bo once told me a story that if you were a member of the literature committee and you didn't have your phone cut off, that just meant you weren't really doing a whole lot.
Makes sense.
It does. So I'm going to introduce you to a man named Jim M. And Jim got involved in the Memphis Lit Conference. During the Memphis Lit Conference, and despite some business commitments, he flew back and forth from Ohio and Memphis several times during February to help prepare the Gray Review form after the Memphis Conference for distribution. But Jim actually was a person. Bo actually had like two lieutenants. He had Joseph P. as one lieutenant, and Jim M. became another lieutenant. And Bo said that Jim was relied upon to catch a logical flaw or to carry out an approved plan of action. And Jim also hosted the Fifth World Lit Conference in Warren, Ohio. And he was very instrumental in emphasizing the consistent language and fellowship specific language. And we learned this by listening to the tapes of the Third Lit Conference about, Jim talking about being specific about that. And Jim was actually instrumental in preparing the style sheet, which is at the end of the Gray Review form. But it's also a style sheet that they voted on and approved in consensus. About how they were actually going to change input and make it fellowship-specific language, such as that if you see the words, condition of abstinence from drugs or sober, you put in the word clean. If you see the word sobriety, you put in clean time. If it talks about drug addict, alcoholic, drug dependent, drug abuser, drug fiend, you put in the word addict or addiction, operating or practicing is the word is using. And it goes onward within the style sheet about that, telling you, just how we should change that and start focusing on more fellowship specific language, because this is the actual place right here at the Third Lit Conference, where you could almost take a snapshot and start watching the teenager, which would be N.A., start to step up and break away from the parent, which is A.A. And one of the specific things that N.A. starts doing is the language-specific, fellowship-specific language.
What occurred to me as I was sitting here looking at this style sheet, where they had the word or phrase that an individual writer may have used on the one side, and then the standardized way that we had agreed to say it or phrase it in the book on the other side, that this was the English-speaking fellowship's version of what all other language groups have experienced when they start out the translations process in their language by creating a glossary. When they come upon this particular word or phrase or concept, they agree upon their language's version of that before they continue with the translations process. So at the time of the writing of the basic text, there was a wide variety of words and phrases used in meetings that may have been borrowed from the treatment center language of the day or the AA language or just a particular way something was phrased in this or that region of the country. The style sheet was an attempt to contain our message within standardized language that would bring a sense of unity to the voice of NA.
And I was telling Boyd, I think it'd be very interesting and also of good service to really kind of describe a little bit of the history of this. And while we were developing fellowship-specific language, there was also some harm that was done to people who had been there previously. And some of the stories we've come across of people who, you know, identified as being clean and sober, not making that adjustment very well, and then either being told that they were uninvited to speak at meetings or conventions because their language hadn't kept up with the times and so forth. And just some of the original origins of that we've learned, and Boyd, you can probably do a little better job talking about it than I could, but the origins that we heard about from people like Norm and so forth about why people were identifying in the 60s and 70s as being clean and sober.
Yeah, actually, I mean, I'll tell you the little story. I met Norm and Oscar at the World Convention in Philadelphia that Dave referenced just a minute ago. And we were outside, and he, Norm actually said to, I mean, he was qualifying himself. He said, you know, I got clean when there were four NA meetings, which I think is 62, I believe is when he said. And, you know, and he said Oscar got clean when there were 25 meetings. And I think those numbers are correct. But anyway, what he said, do you know where the word, you know, clean and sober comes from? And I said, no, not really, Norm. I just kind of figured it was like language that was more treatment center oriented. And he said, oh, no. He said, Boyd, he said, you know, we in L.A. were the ones that were invented clean and sober because, you see, everybody was addicted to opiates back then. And so when they would get clean, they would think, okay, I'm clean now from opiates, but I've got, you know, I can still drink. And we'd go tell them, we'd say, no, brother, you've got to be clean and sober. And he said, that's actually where it originated from. And I thought that was incredibly interesting because I had no clue about that. Zip, so, not a none.
So here they're talking about a way of emphasizing to the newer member that this is a program of total abstinence. And the best way for us to accomplish that is by using clean and sober to let people know, no, this is total abstinence from all drugs, including alcohol. But we've heard some stories of people who kind of grew up in NA using that language who faced a backlash as some of this language changed as the basic text was coming into being and kind of creating a new culture within the meetings for language and terminology.
Yeah.
Ron and Dave, do you guys have thoughts on that?
I sure do. I saw a lot of... you know, when I came in, the language was pretty much just sober, and clean and sober was a later development, pretty quickly thereafter. And then the whole language, I call it the language crusades of the 80s, it really did push some people out who had done quite a bit of work in establishing NA as we know it, were made to feel very unwelcome because they didn't want to give up language that they had learned to treasure and live by on demand. And so there were casualties. I mean, very, very good friends of mine simply stopped going to NA because they just felt it had become an inhospitable place. One fellow I knew who's the helpline for Philadelphia rang in his home. He had two phones in his kitchen. And that's the kind of service he provided to NA. And he was made to feel very, very unwelcome because of the stridency around the language change.
I think that telling that story could be important as a cautionary tale for the fellowship of how things can come along and we can do things that can do exactly what you describe, make people feel unwelcome.
Yeah, I think it still goes on. If I could just add one little thing, treatment centers and drug courts seem to push people into the community with the language that allows them to go wherever they most feel they fit in. And I think that if they're confronted very early on and said, you know, at a particular fellowship, that's not welcomed here, you know, it creates a bit of tension, which I think I call a language synchronicity. People will start to talk the same just by hanging around with each other.
Ron, you got any thoughts?
The points that we're emphasizing are very important points, but it's the one side of that story. Then there is actually another side to that story, which is that the language change itself. And in fact, as I say this to you, I'm looking at this style sheet that's got it's sort of the glossary. It says when you want to say sobriety, instead say clean time. You know, that sort of stuff. The problem with that was the way it was conducted and the sort of the they used to call themselves the East Coast Vigilante Committee. You know, it's a play on the word vigilance. We keep what we have only with vigilance, and they took it to we keep what we have only with vigilanteism, and you know, took it very far. And we could lose another point, but if we overemphasize that, which is that the change itself was really very significant, to say that we have a message that is distinct, and when we use language that conveys that the distinction, that's the way we're going to preserve and sort of crystallize and build on what Narcotics Anonymous is bringing to the party. So I think that's true too, and the overall. The overall effort was really an effort worth doing. But I too, you know, I was all up in it at the time, trying to be one who could speak this sort of reasonableness about it in all directions and see if we couldn't find a way to say this that didn't alienate people and to tolerate those who did not wish to conform. You shouldn't have to conform. We heard from Karen, in an earlier podcast, Karen B., who talked about having been asked to speak at a world convention. And then after, I guess they had listened to some tapes or whatever it was, they called her and disinvited her from speaking because of this issue. So yes, stuff like that was just completely unacceptable. Yeah.
May I also add, it was not enforced, because if you look at Bob B.'s story that made it into the first, second, third, fourth, fifth, and sixth edition, sober is still in there, where he describes his recovery as sober and clean. Jimmy Kay's essay, which survived first, second, third, and third revised editions of the basic text in Recovery and Relapse, talks about emotional sobriety. So I get the style sheet, but it wasn't applied in all cases.
That's true, but I can speak to that too, having been in some of those conversations, that there was, and John F. made reference to this in one of our interviews too, where there was a strong feeling that it's one thing to edit text that you're trying to collaboratively write. It's another thing to edit somebody's story, to edit the way that they told their story. And I believe that both editing is perfectly fine. It's perfectly fine to edit for that style sheet, but there was this kind of a strong feeling among a lot of people that was not okay. And so even when we did the third revised during that modification of the little white book material, we actually did make a decision to edit the stories in the little white book for this. But that was a big, hard conversation. And in the end,
we did not edit any of Jimmy's words during, like you said, it made the to the third revise, because there was just such, it's like you want to do this thing, you want to keep going forward, but you don't want to act in a way that violates the sensibilities of the fellowship because that you're serving.
Thank you.
Yeah, very much. Like
I feel like I'm turning this into an interview of you, Ron. But yeah, anyway, so this is certainly one of those areas for a lot of you can dive into a lot of conversation, and but as Boyd pointed out, it is where we start seeing kind of this unique identity for the fellowship beginning to be articulated and worked into kind of the literature and the culture.
They began now to talk about an audio clip that they had heard, which we don't have here, about how group conscience was applied during this process.
But, you know, he talks about this point of, you know, how do we find a way to include everyone. And what I would say about this is that this part really had a profound impact upon the way that I thought about my role, say, in a mutual aid fellowship business meeting, or my role in my work and, you know, deciding things as a group and how do we reach a decision about certain things. And they talk about group conscience. And it was fascinating because it, you know, it requires a real commitment to time and to listening. And in the clip, you basically, they're debating an issue. And at some point, Bo says, all right, let's go around and hear what people think. And people are asking, are we voting on it? And no, we're not voting on it. And he says, we're going to listen to each person talk for a minute. We're not going to interrupt. We're not going to ask questions. And it's also kind of implied that we're not going to say, oh, wait, I forgot to add one thing, so let me jump back in. It's like each person's going to say what they think. Everyone's going to listen. They're going to go to the next person all the way around the room, no matter how many people are there. And then kind of at the end of it, they talk about, you know, we have a feel of what the group thinks about this and what the group conscience is about this. And it was really impressive to me because it does a couple things. It says it doesn't matter if you're new here. It doesn't matter if you've been around here for a long time. Everyone's equal in terms of being able to share what their thoughts are on this. And then the second thing, it's really real commitment to listening, you know, and that practice of listening and not being focused on, I gotta slide this in, or I gotta make sure people hear my comment on this, and so forth. But we do point out, you know, in this picture, did you get clean when you could smoke at meetings? Because you listen to the audio tapes, there's two things that come across consistently. You hear this kind of horrible screeching of chairs as people are moving around, and you hear lighters flickering throughout. And then you see pictures like this, and there's, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 ashtrays, you know, across 3 or 4 tables. We see a telegram that comes from Jimmy K sent to Joseph P in Memphis on February 7th. And just says the full fruit of a labor of love lies in the harvest, and that always comes in its right season. Yours in fellowship and love, Jimmy. And we see that quote appearing in the beginning of the basic text. They also have some kind of reports given during Memphis. And what's interesting, it says the 1,440 service hours put in by Thursday morning cannot account for the great leap in NA literature taking place in Memphis at the Third World Lit Conference. The fact of our progress seemed to reflect three things. First, that a great deal of groundwork was accomplished at the Wichita and Lincoln Lit Conferences that is only now being evidenced. Second, that a great deal of work has been done since the Lincoln Lit Conference by individuals and areas. So again, kind of emphasizing what we've talked about, that there's a lot of untold stories out there. And their work has been unseen until Memphis. And third, probably the greatest factor of all, is that a potential for new literature has been built up in the spoken traditions of Narcotics Anonymous over the last 28 years. We then see pictures of the gray review form, which was printed after the conference ended. And boy, did you want to chat about this?
It's the work product that came out of Memphis, which it's it was sent out. There were 1,200 of them printed, and they were sent out to every known group in existence that they could find. Plus, they were also sold, I believe, at $10 a piece. They were sent out to the group, so it's free. And there was two of them were sent to Jimmy Kay, first one off the press, and then another. And I think Atlanta got about 12 of them, something like that. But the picture that Chris has up here is of the numbered lines they have. So it was truly a review form. You had the privilege of reading it, and you also had a piece of paper there where you could make a comment, and it had the page number, what page number it is, what line it is, and what's your comment. You do like this, you don't like this, so forth and so on. And it was, it sent it in to the World Lit Committee, and they truly did, you know, take these in accordance and take your comments, whether it be your the group you were working with or your individual comments under consideration when they did the next three three history conferences, not history conferences, excuse me, literature conferences.
I'm looking at that comment form, that input form that they included on the screen right now. It says, starts out with a prayer. God, as we endeavor to complete this work, we know that you are with us. We know that without your strength and inspiration, we are not capable of the task before us. We know that this work is not our work, but yours. Each of us, in our own way, humbly petition you to use us as your tools, according to your will. We offer ourselves to you in this way, knowing that you are a loving God and have all power. In this work and in our lives, thy will be done. And then it says review and input form. It's got a place for the trusted servant's name and the area that that trusted servant represents. And then it says, please review the material carefully. Then either check one or two below. One, we find the material completely satisfactory in its present form. Two, in order that our book may be complete and satisfactory, we recommend the following corrections. If you checked number two, please list the corrections you would make. Be sure to include the sentence number and page number for reference purposes. Please list these corrections in the space below and use additional pages if necessary. If possible, include pages to be corrected or photocopies of these pages with your list. Mailing addresses are listed below, and they give you space to reference your page in line and make your comments.
I can actually remember sitting at my home group on the day this box came in the mail, and we didn't have any idea that it was coming. We didn't even know that it was coming. But you know, we're there for our regular meeting, and I remember who it was, Connie E. comes walking in the room with the box and puts it on the table and starts taking these out. There were like four or five of these books in there.
Wow.
And
cool.
So I got one. I got one right out of that box. I still have it at home.
Do you really? That is great.
Yes, I do.
And Ron, did you share, or am I confusing you with somebody else? Did you share that when you first read it, you thought it was fairly poorly written?
Yeah, I did. I felt like, you know, it was exciting. It was exciting to see where we were, but I felt like there was that the maturity level of the voice was needed a little work still. It felt to me like it was a little bit sort of almost in some places a little, what felt a little cultish or dramatic in the way that it said certain things, a voice which I believe was really tempered and brought to just a great voice by the approval draft. But I was shocked to see it. I had lost a little faith in the process by some of the quality of this one, and it was just my opinion at the time.
Well, it wasn't a sole opinion. I mean, we heard Sally E. talk about this and showing up at the Fourth World Lit Conference in Santa Monica, just kind of saying, you know, what the heck is going on here? You know, who is putting together these sentences? And then being caught up in the spirit of how it was doing and not focusing so much on the quality of the words and how they were structured together.
Yeah. And in their defense, of course, that you just described this cut and paste process and highly collaborative process and this great respect for everybody gets to put their piece in there. And so it shouldn't be shocking that at the end of that process might have a whole lot of great heart and soul, but still needs some work in terms of the style.
Absolutely. And Boyd, as you, this is probably another good opportunity to reinforce what you said earlier about kind of this being an unfunded project by the World Service Office.
Yeah, it was. I mean, I'm sure that if they had had the money, they would have been willing, but it's a matter of they didn't. I mean, the 1,200 copies to make cost $6,000 and some dollars to publish. And so during the Memphis conference, phone calls went out to the fellowship to raise funds up. And, you know, I hear from Bode different amounts, but let's just say that the money did come in and they were actually able to pay for the bill to have these published by Star Printing Company. So, but yeah, I mean, everybody there was, Memphis was huge. I mean, there was, we haven't got to the number of people there yet, I don't believe, or maybe we did, but I think it was 75 some people. And it was, you know, the list there of people who registered and who were there at roll call. I've actually come across two people who say they were at the conference. One person said that his wife chose not to register, but she chose not to have her name on the roll calls, mainly because of anonymity. She chose the right of that. And there was another one that I don't really know why he was not on there, but I feel certain that he was at Memphis because he was describing some scenes that were pretty interesting. So, these numbers that we have are, you know, well, we only know because of what we can sit there in a hard copy, but we have had people who've said they showed up. And like I say, again, it's all self-funded. You know, they all packed up and came to Memphis because, by golly, there was something going on here, you know.
I would love to discover a list of these sheets that were sent in that reflect what type of input was given as people read this, and to see if there was any kind of consistent themes that emerged or not. But that would be an amazing treasure trove to find.
I asked Bo recently, you know, how many literature committees there were, and he told me there were 14, but that doesn't necessarily mean that there were probably way more review committees, because as the momentum went up and, you know, these things went out from Santa Monica and Ohio and such, you know, as the momentum grows, a lot more people were jumping on board. And what we don't know is how many were involved in the review process. But there's pictures up here that we have that we found in Bo's files that are of the gray review forms being made. And there's a person right there by the name of Gene L, who was at, I believe it was called the Memphis House, if I'm not mistaken, that he volunteered to come help. And, you know, Gene is still clean today. And I had an opportunity to meet him when I met Joseph P. At Joseph's 35th anniversary, I believe. And we have up here showing on the slide, actually, a copy of the airslip that was shipped to Jimmy K. with the very first gray review form off the print and press. So it's pretty cool. You can see James P. Kennan, Sherman Way, Sun Valley, California. That would be in the valley, right, Ron?
Yes.
Yes. Then we have a picture here of the actual very first. We have a picture of that copy that was sent and the note that was sent with it. And the note on it says, Jimmy, your personal copy and the first off the printing press for the archives. Love, Roger T. And then here we have a picture of the gray review form that was taken to the 1981 conference. And it says the first book used officially at the WSO conference. And it's got signatures by a ton of people. And it's interesting. We did this in California here recently, and there was a member in the audience that was, when we put that up there, you know, she was really, really looking hard. And I just looked at her, and off the top of my head, I said, is your signature up there by any chance? And she said, yes, yes, it's right there. Nicole C., Nikki C.
And what was cool about that is that she didn't stay in recovery, and she got back into recovery after this and has long-term recovery now, but it felt a little bit diminished for her until she saw the presentation. And she kind of felt validated, you know, that, you know, her contributions did matter, you know, and just because her recovery date changed didn't mean that anything prior to that was not of importance or significance.
Yeah, we got the chance to interview her, and she told us some wonderful stories about traveling across the U.S. You know, her and Gina were very big friends. But this right here, we've got a picture up here, and it says it's of a cake. And this cake was given to they had it at the banquet where they invited all the people from the college, you know, to come and to thank them very much for the use of the facilities at Memphis State University. And it says here, the NA Big Book. So
we're still seeing that language. We got a flyer for the Fourth World Literature Conference, which was held right before the World Service Conference. So it's held Sunday, April 26th through Wednesday, April 29th at Retail Clerks Union Hall in Santa Monica. So it's a shorter conference. The theme is you've seen the book and the time has come. It had 146 people whose names appeared in the minutes and who represented 15 different states. We have a little bit of information on this that we haven't included in the presentation, just kind of listening to Sally E. Talk through an interview we did with her. But we don't focus too terribly much on kind of what happened at Santa Monica in our presentation. And we kind of jump to the Fifth World Lit Conference in Warren, Ohio, which was June 29th through July 5th of 1981, where 115 people attend from 18 different states. And we have, we introduced Sally E., who got clean September 1st, 1969, was on the Board of Trustees and passed away in recovery on August 28th, 2014.
And, you know, there's a lot of things that happened with writing that book and a lot of miracles. And in Ohio, we were divvying up the workload, and there was a guy. And he raised his hand and he said, I can't read and I can't write, but I can cook. And if each of you will give me $3 a day, I'll fix you some good meals. And he did. That guy was so special. I mean, it was so special that he had the courage to do that. How many of us would have been able to do that? He only had a few months. He didn't have that much time. And by the way, Bob B. tells me he's still clean today.
When we interviewed Bill White, he said that our fellowship has an auspicious early history with the involvement of women.
Sally is one of those, and she was actually, I believe, I know that she was the chair of the trustees. And I believe she was the chair of the trustees at the time that the basic text was passed, although I'm not positive of that.
I think you're correct.
Charles Kay again.
Me and Tom, we hitchhiked from Santa Monica to Warren, Ohio for the LitConf. And, I mean, amazingly, it was like one of those God things where you got rides that would take you full states or two states over, and you'd be on the road for maybe 10 minutes and somebody else would pick you up. Well, we hitchhiked there, stayed in Warren. Then we went from Warren, we were going to Miami. So we went through Philly, hitchhiking still, down the coast, stop offs in D.C., Atlanta, and then, you know, made it down to Miami. Nope, don't know anybody. I knew Bob. It's like, Bob, we're coming into town. All right, I got a place for you to stay. Hooked us up at somebody's house, you know, and then I ended up staying. It was like nothing was planned. It's like, well, that's where the World Convention's going to be, and then the Lit Conference is after that. So that's we're going to be there.
Sixth World Lit Conference is held in Miami after the 11th World Convention, which was held at the Marco Polo Hotel. And 60 people came to this. It lasted from the 14th to the 20th. They came from 15 different states. And we have Charles Kay recounting how they read each line and voted on every line. And what came out of the Sixth World Lit Conference was the approval form that was printed in November 1981.
I think what needs to be said about Miami, the Sixth World Lit Conference, too, is that one of the great benefits of having the World Convention there right before is at this particular conference, a lot of the NA mover and shakers that were happening in California came to this. So a lot of the really key players were involved in the final editing process at the Sixth World Lit Conference. And so I think that really needs to be noted.
And we also know that a young man rode his bicycle from Lincoln, Nebraska to Miami to attend the Sixth World Lit Conference. So that's another part of the sweat.
Yeah, person by the name of Doug W.
The Seventh World Lit Conference was in Philadelphia. It was January 15th to the 19th of 82. George R. Hosted it. It's 67 people attend from seven different states. And this is where they focused on the personal stories and trying to decide which story should be in the basic text. And they sent out a list of the stories with the opportunity to check yes or no by each one and to ask how many stories do we want in the book, less than 15, more than 45, how should we deal with references to AA that people may make in the personal stories, and asking for input to be sent there. What's interesting is that when we look at the World Lit Conferences, about 84% of all the people to attend a World Lit Conference only attended one conference. So it was 348 people that we identified in the minutes. And a much smaller number kind of be what we'd say is the glue from conference to conference. So Bo attended all seven. He was the only person to do so. Two people attended six lit conferences. Five people attended five. Five people attended four. So again, kind of a small group that kind of made up the glue to kind of have continuity going through it. We see a motion, and you know, one of the things that Boyd is always reminding us to look for is we're looking for the audio from this 1982 World Service Conference where they voted on the motion for a book, and you know, motion passed, we have a book. It's a pretty significant event in our fellowship's history, or in the fellowship's history. One of the ways that they sought to fund the printing of the book was to do pre-orders for a first edition NA big book which was going to be sold at $25 with a red cover and the inlay lettering Narcotics Anonymous. And so they were sold pre-orders at $25. One of the things as we did these presentations or have done these presentations, we hear very interesting stories. And one came out of Michigan where there were delays in the printing of the basic text. They got a copy of the approval form and started making their own copies because there were so many addicts in need of this literature. And they got kind of a cease and desist note from World Service Office. So they took one of the approval forms that they copied and wrote on the cover, recovery can't wait. And then put approved May 82, kind of as a reminder that this thing was approved, you know, and we need to get it out there. And, you know, addicts are in need and recovery can't wait.
Here they show a number of the covers of the basic text as it was first coming off the presses. There were a couple of silver ones, for example. One of those went to Jeannie and one went to Jimmy Kay. And there was a particularly interesting one with a picture of the Oscar on the cover. We'll let Boyd tell about that one.
Yeah, it seems as though the bookbinder that year had done the Oscars. And he was so taken by, you know, what N.A. was trying to do and helping, you know, people recover that he actually took it upon himself to make a softback first edition with the Oscar cover on it and give it to Jimmy. And so it's the only softback first edition in existence, and it's pretty special.
We show a picture of the commemorative 1 millionth copy from 1988. We've since had the 20th anniversary commemorative edition in 2003 and the 25th anniversary commemorative edition in 2008, as well as the 6th edition coming out then, and then a commemorative 30th anniversary edition in 2013. We talk about the impact of the book, and these are just some brief ideas. We think that it did unify the message and language of Narcotics Anonymous. Bob Stone, in his book, My Years with NA, says NA would not have had the financial resources to meet the challenges that growth in the 80s afforded. And we look at really kind of how slow the growth of NA meetings are. There are 764 meetings in the world when Bo went to the Seventh World Convention in Atlanta. There was 3,300 meetings when the basic text was first published. And as of last count, there's at the 2016 World Service Conference now 67,000 estimated weekly meetings. And the growth of NA really started to increase after the basic text was published very dramatically. We also know that it's been translated, and it may be into more than this at this point, but into at least 26 other languages, making the message of NA available to so many others. And Bob Stone also says that without the book, the message of NA would become fragmented, and the fellowship could have been eclipsed by other recovery movements. I think one of our favorite parts of the presentation is just kind of at the very end, we ask people to share what has the basic text meant to you. And the stories that we hear from people are just, I mean, they're unbelievable, you know, just unbelievable stories that people share when they talk about what the basic text has meant to them.
I caught the presentation of Boyd and Chris at the conference this year in 2016. And when they got to this part of the presentation, they asked people to just raise their hand and share a bit. People shared what their experience was when they first encountered the basic text. Some people encountered it in treatment. Some people had been clean for a while when it was published and they encountered it then. Maybe a good thing to do for us in this podcast is go to the My Recovery Cast Facebook page and do some sharing right there. What was your experience of encountering the basic text for the first time?
I mean, you know, it was a wonderful experience for me at the World Service Conference when all the folks from around the world got up and talked about it. It was very eye-opening.
I'd like to say something. You know, again, thank you guys. history is been a big part of my recovery for the last 20 years. And it's a way that I feel, it's made me feel even more connected to the fellowship. And I had the great pleasure during the World Service Conference with the three of you and our good friends from New York, Elwood, Tommy, and Lynn, to go around to the sites where so many of the events of the earliest meetings on the West Coast, where the literature really began to take shape. And it was just a great day. It was a lovely day in my life. It was a wonderful experience. And there were so many great stories told back and forth. I'm a latecomer to the basic text that came out in 81. And at that point, I'm 7 or 8 years clean. And I've just come to love the book because it sounds like meetings sounded when I came in. And that's what I love about it. And the fact is that it is basic. And, you know, there's a tendency at times the people in the fellowship can get very obscure and things can go spinning off into abstractions. And that book always brings me back because it is so simple, I think, to understand and so spiritual and so basic that I've really come to love it. And thank you for your effort in bringing this story to life.
All right.
So I'm trying to think of, you know, the music starting to play right now at the end of the podcast and something, you know, real endearing that could be said, you know.
We could get you two to sing a little bit of We Are the World. All right. Well, thanks again for all of your work. It's just phenomenal work. And I know that when I heard this presentation at the World Service Conference this year, it just really fired me up again. It warmed me up again for this bit of the history, this miracle that is the emergence of the basic text kind of out of the heart and soul of this fellowship. And you guys capture it really well. So to our listeners, if you guys haven't seen Boyd and Chris make any of their presentations and they happen to be at a convention that you're at, I strongly recommend it. It's phenomenal work. So thank you guys.
And I was told about the first World Literature Conference that was coming up a few months later up in Kansas. And so I'd arranged for the Beau to come back, come through Memphis and pick me up and go up there. I didn't know what it was going to be about. And on the way, talked about a lot of things. And we talked about we were going to write this wee book. And they kept talking about for days this wee book we're going to write. And all this information that Greg had and other people had was getting piles and the copy machine was running. And I couldn't figure out how they're going to get all this material in a small book. And it went on and on and on. And what I finally figured out after that commission, the wee book, is that we together and not small. But I never asked. So that's where I was.